This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
Thank you very much all for being here. Before we begin, I want to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, and to pay my respects to their elders past and present, and to all Indigenous people. So we are here today to celebrate the extraordinary Kate Tempest and her new novel, The Bricks That Built the Houses. An astounding debut for those of you who haven't read it yet. You must read it. My name's Maxine Beniba Clark, and I'll be your host for this evening. And basically, I'm just going to be completely selfish and ask Kate everything I want to know about her and her work. I feel like, you know, I was joking on Twitter that my first question would be, will you be my best friend? And if not, explain why. So I feel like there's a few people in the audience going, she's going to say it, you know. But I'm really interested to know, I know you've said that you've been writing since before you can remember, really. Mm. You started out as a lyricist, really, a rapper. And I recently moved house about 6 months ago, and I found this box of, the old lyric sheets you used to get with cassettes and CDs?
Yeah.
And I was so doggy, and I was like, oh, yeah, they don't have those anymore because, you know, digital age, we download everything. And so the first question I'm wanting to ask you is, if we found your lyric sheet box, the baby writer Kate Tempest at, you know, kind of 16 or 17, what would be in there? What kind of things did you used to listen to?
Well, okay, so at like 16 or 17, I was listening to hip-hop basically at that time. But the first, like, lyric sheet that I studied would have been Michael Jackson. Mm-hmm. And it would have been Bad. I know you're meant to say Thriller, but it's just not true. Yeah. Like, it was it was Bad, really. I was so blown away by that. But then when I was about 16 or 17, I was listening to Tribe Called Quest and Lauryn Hill and Gangstar, and I was listening to Grave Diggers and the Wu-Tang Clan, and I was listening to Mos Def and Pharoah Monch, and just the kind of lyricists, you know? Mm-hmm. That these are the ones, especially Pharoah Monch, actually, at that time. Because I think Infernal Affairs had just come out, and but then also like Bob Dylan and The Clash, and lots of different music. My connection with music was always the lyrical connection, and like it actually, although hip hop just, I felt like I'd found something that just rung my bones, like bells, you know. But anything that I listened to, I could engage with the lyrics of, even if it was, you know, a kind of crap pop song, I could still be moved by the lyric, like, you know. Even, well, I won't even go into how terrible some things that move me are.
And how did that, you know, how did you go from a listener to a participator? You know, do you remember that first time you thought, you know, I want to write something, and I think they're going to be lyrics?
Interesting. Well, I was always writing. A lot of my friends were MCs and rappers, and I kind of left it to them, you know, left it up to the boys. I think there's something that happened. Look, all my friends were blokes, like my close friends anyway. And I think there's something that happens when you just, you leave it up to the people that you think are really good at it, you know? Like, and that first jump into being like, could I ever speak this stuff that I write out loud? And then, one day I just did. I just tried it out, you know? It was just there, we were hanging out. I actually phoned up my friend on the house phone. You remember the house phone used to be a real big thing? You had to like wait till nobody could hear you, and like it was always like under the stairs, you know, that little bit. Like that. And then I think it was like 2 days later, really, my friend took me to this. We used to go down to this record store. It's called Deal Real. It was a record store on Carnaby Street in town, and it felt like this really kind of anarchic takeover of central London, because it was a hip-hop store by day, and then every Friday night they would turn a couple of crates over, and then rappers would just pack the shop out, spill out onto the street. It started about 7 o'clock, it would go until night time, and then on the bus home, and like, you know, and I saw some amazing MCs in that place from the UK scene, but also American rappers would come over and just do little ciphers there. So that was my baptism of fire was in Deal Real Records, which is, it was like kind of packed, like so many people, big guys. Mm. I was tiny. I looked about 8 years old. You know what I mean? Like, a lot of people asking me if I got lost on the way to the sweet shop. And I was like, no, I'm here to do this. And that was the beginning.
And we do think of, you know, rap as, you know, the domain of kind of hyper-masculinized men of colour. What was it like negotiating that, you know, particularly when you're someone who's new to the scene, you know, standing in front of rooms essentially mostly blokes, you know, delivering your soul?
Well, the connection that I had with the art form was so raw and real that I think that it surpassed any discomfort that I might have felt or nerves or anxieties about, you know, wanting to be heard. Especially within that culture at the time, it was like a woman could be looked at amongst my friends even as well, like, but to be listened to was a bit of a different thing, you know. But I could just allow all that. That was okay. I could listen to homophobia and misogyny, which I often did, and it was just like, it didn't really touch me because my heart was so full of the form, really, and I was so moved by rappers. I was so connected to a good lyric when I heard it, that I think that there was just this current of recognition in terms of true love for lyricism. So for me, it was like finding my place. And I think that when you're at that age, when you're looking for yourself in a bigger context, I think a lot of like young teenagers find their space in music and in literature and in poetry. You know, that's the kind of beautiful, transcendent nature of this stuff, is that you find the world in a piece of fucking vinyl, you know, and there's the universe that you've been looking for, you know. So that for me, it was like school, and it was like celebration, and it was partying, it was everything, you know. But especially school, I'll let you talk again in a minute.
So what were you reading? I mean, when your work has been reviewed, people tend to, you know, they talk about you being a rapper, but they also compare you to the English canon. And sometimes I think that's because they don't know the other, you know, the history of the other canon that you come from in terms of spoken word.
Interesting.
But were you reading a lot of traditional poetry around this time as well?
No, not really. I came to poetry pretty late, to be honest. Like, I never really thought it was for me in that way. I read a lot of novels. And I read lots and lots. I read voraciously, like, all the time, but mainly fiction, and listened to music. And, I mean, I read a few poets who I knew were going to blow me away, but I didn't know how to investigate and find poetry that was, you know. It was the kind of thing somebody might tell you to read. Read this, you might be into it. But then I fell into poetry through spoken word, yeah, and through... It was that kind of thing which I found by accident, because it turned out that I could go to a spoken word event. I didn't need a DJ or a band, and I could do a gig, you know, on my own, which was, it meant, because I went at a tireless pace, and it was difficult to find collaborators who could keep up with how much I wanted to do, really. So I fell in love with poetry much, much later into my life, like in my kind of early 20s or late teens, really. But I think the thing about poetry is, if you don't find it on your own terms, you'll never find it. You know, somebody can't tell you to enjoy a poem. Like, it doesn't make any sense unless you've found it on your own terms, in your own way. And I understand why we teach it in schools. I get that. But, like, I think it's never as effective as when you discover it for yourself. And that's when it will set everything on fire, you know?
So before you came to spoken word, were you listening to people like Gil Scott-Heron or The Last Poets or those kind of...
Yeah, of course. I had a job at a record store when I was 14. I worked there, and I worked in record stores until my early 20s. And so was listening to recordings of anything that I could possibly get my hands on or my head around, you know? So, yes, of course, Gil Scott-Heron. And just anything that I knew was... Anybody I knew was a famous lyricist. Yeah. You know, anybody. Like... Yeah. I would just check them out, and I'd try and work out why have I heard of this, and why are people so excited about this? And if it didn't click with me, it would be like, is this my problem? Like, what am I not seeing? And some of it, I suppose, is being too young or just not being into it. But yeah, I was on a hunt. You know, this was this was me just like every day was a pilgrimage, you know.
And so when you moved from rap into spoken word, was it a different crowd, a very different crowd?
It was a different crowd. Yeah, yeah. But it's always a different crowd. And the thing is, like, in the nature of my work, I've been very blessed because I've got to perform to so many different kinds of people. There's one day that sticks out in my mind because it was such a forcible difference, which is that I'd spent the day in a women's prison in London, which was a really heavy place, actually. Like, the maternity wing was the thing that really got me, because women would go in there pregnant, and there's, like, you know, bumblebees painted on the wall, but it's a jail, you know. And once the baby's 6 months, it will go into care. And so it was a really heavy day of doing... I'd written a play, which was a forum theatre play, and I was doing some poetry with the women, and I was having, you know, this really kind of moving but heavy day. You know, it's real. I was telling a poem to this room full of inmates, and the lyrics had never meant what they meant in that moment. Suddenly, this whole poem was transformed. It was the most important poetry performance I'd ever given, I felt, in that moment. And I had to leave there to go to this fucking awards ceremony for the Ted Hughes Prize for Poetry in Mayfair, which is like... to put it in context, I've never been there before, right? Like, and it's in this big townhouse, and there's white wine and canapes and the lot. And I was saying to my girlfriend at the time, like, I don't think we should go. I don't want to go. I'm not going to win this prize. I don't even want to be around that. And then that's the night I won the Ted Hughes Prize for Poetry. And everything changed.
Yes. And for those of you who haven't read it, The Brand New Ancients is an incredible epic narrative poem. And you toured globally, really, performing it with a live orchestra. Tell us a bit about the Brand New Ancients and the inspiration behind it.
Well, it's a story about two families as they kind of intertwine in life, but it's set against this idea that reclaims the heroism of the everyday, you know, and it tries to vanish some of the myths about what makes a person worthy of celebration, and also to kind of realign the divine with the human in terms of what we are capable of. I mean, it's so hard to speak about a poem. It's just much more effective to just read the poem, or for me to tell you the poem. You know, it's like...
Good advice.
Do you know what I mean? I understand there's, like, institutions dedicated to the study of poetry, but, like... but just not... That's not my bag. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So that takes us to 2012. You're touring with the Brand New Ancients. You had an album come out in 2014, Everybody Down. Yeah. And which was the genesis, really, for the bricks that built the houses. So whereabouts did that come in this journey? Were you working on that while you were working on the Brand New Ancients? Or?
Well, it's all the things are kind of mixed up a little bit, because I've been touring kind of constantly for the last 4 or 5 years with one thing or another. And while I've been in breaks between tours, or while I've been on the road, I've been thinking of new ideas and trying to pursue them and trying to write them. So Everybody Down, Brand New Ancients, my first play, Wasted, and The Bricks That Built the Houses are all populated by the same characters, set in the same place. And The Bricks is kind of the final chapter in a body of work that I've been working on for about 5 years. So the genesis of it is kind of hard to untangle, because they're kind of all part of each other's genesis. And it's not like I began writing the first play knowing it was going to lead to everything, but it's just this kind of... There was more to say. There was more that needed to be out, you know? I could just feel it all pushing around. And when the idea came for Everybody Down and The Bricks, the idea came for both a novel and a record, I knew these two things were going to go hand in hand, you know?
Yeah.
But I suppose what's interesting is that I've always engaged with music in a kind of literary way. It's always been the lyrics first. And I've always engaged with novels in quite a musical way, because the words sing for me, you know, and the rhythm for me is kind of addictive. Obviously, I've spent a lifetime thinking about flow and rhythm and meter and cadence and all this stuff. So for me, the two things, literature and music, they're the same thing for me, you know. So I think it's more of a shock for other people.
Yeah, yeah. And this is something I think that as writers, I think you're often pushed into a particular form, or you start out in a form and people expect you to stay in that form. But I think very much your stylistically, your work is you know, very similar no matter what medium you're working in. You know, there's that kind of intensity and exploration of, you know, ordinary people in this kind of extraordinary way. The chapters in The Bricks That Built the Houses...
It's so amazing that you've read it all.
So cool. I'm a crazy fan. Don't come too close to me. I'm one of those people that will jump the table. So the chapters in The Bricks That Built the Houses follow a track each from the album.
Yeah.
And I've read that you wrote the first draft of this in a week in the back of a tour bus. And when I read that, I thought, I hate her. So I want to know a bit more about the process. You know, was the album a blueprint and you kind of knew where you were going with it? Was it a writing frenzy? How did it unfold?
Okay, so that's two things mixed into one. So I wrote the first draft, which I was talking to an amazing writer in America, actually, and she was saying, we were talking about these first drafts, and actually, it was the zero draft. It was not the first draft yet. You know, it was just, I wrote it all in a notebook. It was before, I wrote that first draft to just get, to see if I could get to the end of this idea, you know, and it was furious. It was like, I'd been waiting all my life to have an idea big enough to merit the form of a novel, which was a form that I respected and loved, but up until that point, I'd wanted to write a novel more than I had an idea that needed me to write a novel, you know? And I think that writers can identify with that. We know it. We can feel it when it's like, is this my ego or is this an idea? You know, and very soon you will work out which one it is. You know what I mean? When it starts to be bullshit. I wrote this, the first draft of that in the gap between... Okay, this sounds complicated, it's not. I've met this music producer who's incredible, right? We have this amazing connection. I've been trying to get into his studio for years. He's very busy, successful music producer. I was a poet. Mm-hmm. There was like, do you know what I mean? His manager was having none of it. Like, so eventually I got into the studio with him on some downtime. He called me up, got a couple of hours. We made this demo, which became Lonely Days. And when that was just written in the studio, it was him and her, there were no characters yet. And we wrote this kind of this demo of Lonely Days. And by the time I got back into his studio, which would have been a few months later, I'd just been turning this him and her around in my head. They'd become Pete and Becky. I'd been thinking about who they were. The idea had started to take shape. It had grown legs. It was walking around. I smashed out that zero draft in a week because that's all I had. And then took that first draft into the recording studio and was like, okay, great. We've got a few days. I've written all this stuff. And each one of these chapters is going to be a track. Initially, all the tracks on the album were called Chapter 1, Chapter 2, Chapter 3. Mm-hmm. The draft of the novel informed the draft of the record. The first tracks, just stay with me, it'll make sense in a minute. The first tracks on the album, some of them were like 12 minutes long, you know? They were long. And so we just cut them. It just got tighter and tighter. And then after making the record, which is a really intense period of time and work, I had some time and space to breathe, and I went back in and worked... the draft that was in the notebook up to a kind of draft that I sent out. So that became the first draft, which had no punctuation, no paragraphs, and no speech marks. So I had learnt grammar through reading, right? Yeah. And thought that I was like pretty up on it, but it turns out I've been reading some pretty experimental fiction. Which was a hard pill to swallow, you know, because I was like, of course, you just get it. Yeah. Like, it makes sense, right? And a lot, like, because I've been writing plays, a lot of my dialogue was just kind of list of dialogue. I didn't know that you were meant to... So then the second draft was me kind of learning these lessons, my editor being like, okay, let's talk about paragraph breaking, which I then did and actually got a real kick out of it and learnt a lot. Yeah. And then it was the third draft when Harry became a woman, which I wrote in the back of the tour bus. We were touring America... The second draft of this novel was the one after with the punctuation in it. That was like four times as long as the finished book, because this is something I realised. You have to know everything about everyone. Yeah. You have to know so much about them that I ended up writing like characters that don't even exist anymore, that were like... I really went in on their backstory as well, but they just don't even exist in the text. They're not even there anymore. But for me, it was important that I went on that journey with the space, with the whole universe of it. Because if I hadn't done, you might have been able to feel that absence in the finished text. Anyway, then that one had to then become this one. And that's the one that I wrote in the back of the tour bus.
Yeah, yeah.
It's exhausting, isn't it? Imagine writing it.
And that was going to be one of my questions. You know, I wanted to know, did any of the characters get killed off in the writing of this? Because it's so expansive yet so tight. You know, there are so many different characters for a novel. And you do get that sweeping sense of, you know, you get all of their backstory. You know, you meet a character and you get what's essential to know to where they are, up to where they are now. Was that always something that you wanted to do, to kind of find the histories of these characters and work them into the present tense narrative?
That's such a good question. So the album exists. The album is this kind of 48-minute tight linear, or some would say episodic, but I don't see it that way. For me, it's like driving, you know, and it tells the story. The plot exists. The record's out there. It exists. The novel was always meant to be this more expansive kind of journey into the interior worlds and also the place, South London. So in novels and in, you know, films and in lots of works of art, we are used to following one character through their life, you know, usually male, And, you know, the hero's journey or whatever. And actually what I think is much more important for me in the way that I experience life is the community of life. You know, I live in a big city. Everywhere I look, every single time I look anywhere, go anywhere, there's thousands of people that I pass full of life and love and death and pain. And this, for me, is the most intoxicating and beautiful thing about living, and is what sends me constantly to write and try and make sense of it. So I wanted the novel to carry some of this kind of multiplicity, which I think is a more true experience of living and is actually more important in terms of beginning to shift our thoughts away from my life, my life, my life, I'm the hero, to like our life, actually, our life. Mm. You know, we share this, and, you know, your life is nothing without the lives around it. So the novel being such an important form for activating empathy in readers, I thought it was important that we have the kind of multiplicity of characters and give each of them the space that they deserve in order to live, you know, like, and I thought it was also important there's no villains, there's no heroes, these are just people. You know, that I was on this kind of... I've been on a bit of a journey with it because I know it's not really the done thing. And I didn't really realise that until once it was published. And I think some people find it exhausting, and I think other people have found it exhilarating. But I suppose we were talking about this a bit backstage. Whatever anyone thinks of it, that's what it is now. So... Mm. I've, you know, my role in it, even though I'm talking about it now, my role's kind of finished, and it's completely whatever you take of it, whatever you make of it, that's what it is, you know? So if you are exhausted by it, I'm sorry, but it's on you now.
I think what's extraordinary about it is you get these kind of nuances through telling the histories of these people. And at one point we meet the stepfather of one of the characters, is an optometrist, and he, to all appearances, if you met him in a traditional narrative, you know, he's very middle class, very kind of beige, middle of the road, nothing remarkable. But then you get this backstory of his father dying and his mother sending him out to work, or him going out to work at 16, and his mother, spoiler alert, you know, collects his paychecks every week, and he thinks that he's supporting her. And then when she passes away, he realises that, no, she was fine. She had money all along. But, you know, this was something that was a major thing in the making of him, that he felt like he was supporting his mother. And in a traditional narrative, not knowing that, you know, he's just this beige optometrist character. So, you know, as a reader, that's what I really loved about it, that as soon as you get these characters' histories, it completely changes the way that you look at them now.
That's so cool that you noticed that. Because, yeah, David in the record is treated pretty scathingly. The one line is like, even David's enthusiasm is boring. So he's like, and he's just this guy, you know. But actually then in the novel, he's given this scope, because actually David's living a really truthful life. He's actually completely, he just is that way. He is kind of well-meaning and a bit kind of simplistic and not very adequately adapted to social conversations. You know, he's just this kind of odd guy. But I suppose what's interesting is that at any moment in any of our lives, if we were to look again at anyone, we would realise that there is much more to them than we at first perceived or allowed our judgments to tell us. You know, there are no brackets that can fit around any human being. And I know this from art as well, or any artist. There are no brackets you can put around an artist that could ever adequately sum up what they're capable of. And actually, the more we limit ourselves in how we understand our own capacity to work or to be, the less likely we are to be able to ever even begin to reach what could be our potential, you know?
Mm. Would you give us a reading?
Yeah, sure. Can I borrow your book?
Excuse all the folded over corners.
Oh, interesting note. Rubbish! No. So, the book begins with a quote from William Blake, and as I've been reading these out, I've been reading a few lines of Blake out as well. He's one of my favourite poets, and I go to him often when I don't realise how much I need him, and then I realise that I'm reading him again. And the reason I wanted to include a few lines of Blake is because the novel is so tightly centred on these characters. You know, their lives are so all-encompassing for them. But the idea is that to begin with some Blake, it gives us a glimpse into the kind of epic scale and the grandeur and the kind of foreverness of life and existence. And it plugs us into this more epic framework, even though then what happens is we go kind of straight into the tunnel of life in a city. But I think that in a lot of my work, there is this thing at play about kind of allowing yourself to pan out and realise the actual scale of how we exist and what we've become and everything. So William Blake says, "They told me that the night and day were all that I could see. They told me that I had 5 senses to enclose me up. And they enclosed my infinite brain into a narrow circle and sunk my heart into the abyss, a red, round globe, hot, burning. It gets into your bones. You don't even realize it until you're driving through it, watching all the things you've always known and leaving them behind. They're driving past the streets, the shops, the corners where they made themselves, and every ghost is out there staring, bad skin and sunken eyes, grinning madly at them from the past. It's in their bones. Bread and booze and concrete, the beauty of it, all the tiny moments blazing. Preachers, parents, workers, empty-eyed romantics going nowhere. Streetlights and traffic and bodies to bury and babies to make. A job, just a job. And people are killing for gods again. And money is killing us all. And they live under a loneliness so total it has become the fabric of their friendships. Their days are spent staring at things. They trust nothing but trends. The most that they can hope for is a night out smashed to pieces, sloppy face from booze and drugs that hate them in the morning. But here they are, leaving the stress and shit food and endless misunderstandings, leaving the job centre, the classroom, the pub, the gym, the car park, the flat, the filth, the TV, the constant swiping of news feeds, the Hoover, the toothbrush, the laptop bag, the expensive hair product that makes them feel better inside, the queue for the cash machine, the cinema, the bowling alley, the phone shop, the guilt, the absolute nothingness that never stops chasing, the pain of seeing a person grow into a shadow, the people's faces twisting into grimaces again, losing all their insides in the gutters, clutching lovers till the breath is faint and love is dead. Wet cement and spray paint, the kids are watching porn and drinking Monster. Watch the city fall and rise again through mist and bleeding hands. Keep holding on to power ballad karaoke hits. Chase your talent, corner it, lock it in a cage. Give the key to someone rich and tell yourself you're staying brave. Tip the chair back, stare into the eyes of someone hateful that you'll take home anyway and tell the world you're staying faithful. Nothing's for you, but it's all for sale.
Now give until your strength is frail, and when it's at its weakest, burden it with hurt and secrets. It's all around us, screaming paradise until there's nothing left to feel. Suck it up, gob it, double drop it, pin it deep into your veins. Now try forever to get off it. Come on, close your eyes and stop it. But it never stops. They leave town in a fourth-hand Ford Cortina. It's night, and the city is full of itself. There is thunder in the sky, the kind of clouds that make you bow your head. They are heading for the motorway. Leon is driving. His shirt's damp with sweat. His arms are sore at the wrists from gripping the wheel. He sits low down in the driver's seat, but the top of his head still kisses the roof of the car. Now, Leon is muscular, built like a fighting dog. He's 6'2" and light on his feet, and his movements are liquid slick. Leon's face is screwed up with worry as he turns left down the roads he's always known and pushes the tired engine up Blackheath Hill towards the A2 roundabout, weaving between the clattering suction of the heavy goods lorries. Now, Harry's in the back. She's got one arm stretched across the top of the seat. She's drumming her fingers and she's shifting her weight. Harry is small and she's getting smaller every second. Her little body's hunched in the back of the car. Her limbs are splayed like the arms of a broken umbrella, and she's jittering. She clutches the brown suitcase that rests on her lap. She grips the handle so tight its stitches are imprinted on her palm. Fear knots her shoulders and they spike together at her back like folded wings. Becky's in the front. Becky's legs are crossed tightly, her elbows are tucked into her hips, and she's biting her thumbnail. Becky's body is taut as a tripwire, her features are soft and generous, like the faces carved in stone on temples. Nose pierced with a shining stud, she has a mouth that turns up at the corners. She is tall and straight-backed with a commanding presence, and her dark eyes stare at the dark road while the dark car shakes on its wheels. So Becky watches the wing mirrors. She notices every movement, every fierce headlight. Harry watches the cars behind. Leon keeps his eyes on the road. If someone is coming after them, not much they can do but keep going. A suitcase full of money sits fat and happy as a baby. Harry can't stop glancing down at it and noticing its shape. Nobody has spoken in a full 10 minutes. The silence is loud, and it's getting louder. Eventually, Leon's voice limps from his chest and staggers out of his mouth. Out of town or what? Out the country. And he hunches over the wheel. Nobody answers. The seconds pulse as they pass. It's a mess, he says. Harry thinks hard, breathing carefully. How serious are your uncles, Becky? And Becky sees them in her mind's eye, smiling and blood-covered. She speaks calmly, without ceremony. She says, depends what you've done. And her words smash through the floor of the car, rip the undercarriage into pieces, and leave their feet exposed, skimming hot tarmac. Think they know you're with us, Leon asks Becky. Pete might work it out, she says. And Pete's name hangs in the air like a shot bird about to fall out of the sky. Then, true enough, plummets softly into their laps and sits there, warm and bleeding. Pete. What a little cunt, says Leon with affection. The car returns to silence, each alone with their panic, rising, falling, rising higher. The tension clogs their mouths. Becky turns in her seat to look at Harry, and her face is lit by passing streetlights. We'll be okay, she smiles. And all the streets in Harry's heart are on fire. All the windows in all the houses smash at the same time. A tidal wave charges in, puts the fires out, and the water floods the houses and comes pouring through the broken windows, carrying debris on its waves. And Becky turns back to the window, stares at the brief white lights of the shops they pass. Seen then gone, seen then gone. Brutal, blazing flashes, like someone shouting swear words in your face. The roads are getting broader. The houses are getting bigger. Fewer chicken shops now, more gastro pubs. Their city is loosening its hold. They're turning onto the motorway. And on the radio, Billy Bragg is singing A New England.
Wow, thank you. You've said in the past, you know, when people have referred to you as a political writer, how can you create art really in these times without being political? But there are kind of decisions that you make in the bricks that build the houses that are really character decisions but have a lot of politics behind them. Becky, for example, who's a dancer in the book, she supports herself through sex work, essentially, to support her creative outlet. But she's not disempowered. Mm-hmm. And I think she's one of the few sex worker characters I've read that isn't, you know, in some way compromised. You know, she understands what she's doing. She has agency. And similarly, Harry, you know, you've made her a very small-statured female drug dealer. How much thought goes into those decisions? Is it purely a character thing, or do you kind of look at your themes and think, okay, I want to make Harry a woman because that, you know, I can play more with the politics around that?
Wow, this is the best one yet. You know this. Well, I think that for me personally, the decisions, yeah, are all about the characters. But of course, my politics will come out in the characters that I create. But I never ask the politics to be there, you know, because otherwise you cripple the idea before it's had time to find its feet. You know, I don't begin any project thinking I know what I want to say. You know, even if I know the story I want to tell, I don't tell myself what that story is going to say about anything. You know, like Becky, for me, is a very important character. Because, yeah, she's completely positive and empowered by the work that she does. And also, I've not really come across positive depictions of women who work in the sex industries, especially not coming from a kind of hip-hop background as well, you know? Mm-hmm. So, although there is often, every time you kind of flick on a film or, you know, there is always some kind of prostitute getting murdered. You know, and it's like no big deal. You know, I know it's a kind of flippant thing to say, but because I'm in a hotel and I put a telly on last night and there was some bullshit film and there was a prostitute getting murdered and it was like no big deal. So that's only why I bring that up. But the deep silence in the room makes me think you've not been watching the same films that I've been. But the way that I feel about sex work is that I think it should be. I think it should be legalized because for the people at the top of society, they are free to make their money in the most corrupt and immoral ways, but within the constraints of a legal system which they have created and bought, and which sanctions the most corrupt decisions that they make. But then at the bottom of society, when all you have maybe is your own body to support yourself, even at that level, you're still manipulated, controlled, and oppressed by a system which is controlled for the benefit of the people that are oppressing you. I don't know if that's, but I know that here it's a different situation, but in the UK anyway, I think that they're, you know, women can be arrested for supporting themselves that way. In terms of Harry, like, I wanted Harry to be a woman for so many reasons. Mm-hmm. You know, I know a hell of a lot of very cool queer women, but I've not really read many, yeah, you know, so I wanted her to be the woman that I wish I'd had a chance to read when I was a kid, you know. I wish I'd read a Harry rather than constantly hating myself for not being the hero in other people's dramas, you know. Mm-hmm. But the reason I wanted her to be a woman was not so much to do with the occupation. Like, she began life as a man. Even up until the third draft, like I was saying, Harry was male. Harry's male in the album. But then something interesting happens where people are like, oh, how clever. You made her a man in the album. Now she's a woman. Is this a comment on gender fluidity? And like I'm saying, if that's what it is for you, then like, brilliant, how clever. But like, at its root, it was an instinctive decision, which was made because I knew that's what had to happen for the character. And interestingly, I said this the other night, but I think it's interesting to repeat, like, for Becky, I had to work extremely, extremely hard for her not to fall into conventional narrative traps of becoming a kind of passive woman. Mm. I had to work really hard to make her live as a whole human being. For Harry,
Just to try this out, you know, I changed the pronouns in two paragraphs and suddenly here was a whole human being because she'd begun her life being conceived as a male character. And I think that's kind of interesting that even as a woman writer who cares very much about female characters, I still had fallen into the trap of the limitations that occur when you think, I'm going to tell a story, who's in it? A woman. Oh, okay, a woman. And then suddenly you're limiting yourself even before you've begun to know the character. And then obviously after I didn't just change the pronouns, like I went through, I did write the character again. But I mean, that in terms of the politics, it's been an interesting time politically over the last couple of weeks in terms of me and my politics and how apparently vocal I've been about them. This book is the end of a, as I was saying, a kind of constellation of work that I've been getting towards, and it feels like a real moment in terms of coming into a new phase now of my writing, having got to the end of this, which I've been working towards for so long. And actually, this is the last gig on this Australian tour. This is the last night of it, and I should just say to you guys in this room and to you, and this has been a really monumental and kind of incredibly moving and difficult moment in my career and life, actually, because some big decisions got made about detaching myself from the work enough to suddenly find myself speaking Kate Tempest, the person speaking, rather than Kate Tempest's work speaking. And I've realised so many things about what I need to ask my work to do. For the last 30 years, I've been, well, 15 years really, where I've been working, I've been following a creative current. I've been like just on this current, just following it, just going, just moving as fast as I could. And now I just turned 30 in December, and this coming out, it feels like a real moment. And now I feel like it's time to lead that charge a little bit more. And it's been a sequence of debuts, a debut play, a debut printed collection of poetry, a debut novel, debut album. And it's like I was building a foundation from which that when I speak now, it's serious, you know, like, and for a long time I was building this up so that I wanted to get to a point where when I spoke, I could be heard by as many people as possible. I didn't just want to speak to people who already felt like me. And I made that decision, you know, quite young and decided to get on this path, basically. And then I felt like the other night, I know I'm just off on one now, but I'm going to just talk about it. I didn't want to jump the gun and speak too soon, you know, because I didn't want people to switch off because of left or right politics about what essentially is a human message about that I think is very important to be able to articulate. So I had for a long time held back from saying too much or allowing myself to be too present in that. And then suddenly I find myself getting off a plane and being in a Q&A TV studio with some of the most intelligent people, you know, I've ever stood within 2 miles of. And like, it was time. So I kind of want to acknowledge that this has been a really momentous and important trip for me. It's taught me a hell of a lot. I'm still working out what it is that I'm learning, but thank you for your time and your space and for whatever's happening in this land, because something's going on.
I feel like at this point in Australia and for where we are in Australian politics, it's fantastic to have someone like you touring the country, and you know, it's we can often be geographically isolated. I was saying before, I feel like writers or people from the UK or US come here and we just grab them, like, yeah, don't leave, we love you, yeah, you know. But I feel like, you know, you've arrived here at a very important time and arrived yourself, really.
Yeah, it's very, really very moved me. Yeah. I feel very moved by this place. So just to let you know, like, I'm very moved by what's happening here, by Australia.
And so saying that, I'm going to put you on the spot and say, where to next? Do you have something that you're thinking of writing? Do you have an urge to write? We were talking backstage about this competition and this strangeness between actually being in that writing cave and, you know, essentially being on stage or being on tour and the struggle of finding time to actually create more work. Do you have something you're working on? Or?
I've got a new record which is finished. I work like a fucking lunatic. I work so much. Like, so the next record is finished, and actually the next record, funnily enough, is much more explicit politically, it does have a clear message, I think, which emerged actually through the characters and the plot of this record coming about. Similarly, I didn't ask it to do that. This is just where I'm at, you know? This is just what's happening in terms of where I'm at in my life and what I can see when I look around. So the next album, I don't know if I can say what it's called yet or anything, but I'm really proud of it. It's a big moment, I think, for me in terms of my development as a lyrics writer. That'll be out, and I'm working on the one that follows it, and I've got an idea for a new book. I'm working on a translation of a play, of an old play.
Just a few small
projects. Yeah, it's happening. I'm like, there is no plan to take the foot off the pedal as yet.
Kate's going, I'm not sure I want people to clap at that.
Yeah, right.
Kill
yourself.
When do I get a holiday?
Kill yourself.
So on that note, we might go to question time. So raise your hand if you do have a question. There's a mic on either side, and the mic will come to you and speak when it comes. And please don't be shy.
Hi.
Hi.
So in the novel, I've noticed you have this tendency to go from an everyday situation into quite an extreme metaphor, like you've in the Paris passage you've just read, we go from sitting in the car to London being on fire and tsunamis and whatnot.
And does that not happen in your life?
Occasionally on Saturday nights, but mostly not. And some of the descriptions of hangovers I noticed are pretty pretty metaphorical. I'm just wondering whether you could speak about that technique and that sort of movement from the everyday to that kind of metaphor.
Well, the most truthful way that I can describe a situation is in that voice. Like, the way that I experience life is that full on. Like, I think there is something about being a poet, maybe, that means that you plug in to life at a certain frequency, you know, whether you want to or not. I am so struck and moved and, like, wrenched and do you know what I mean? Like, it's like life is a big thing for me. It's huge. Things have really, really hit me. When two people look at one another and there is a sexual chemistry or an attraction there, like, to write that moment, for me personally, I have to resort to pretty heavy metaphor. You know, I have to go there. Things have to really be moving, exploding and, like, burning and, like, yeah, like, shining. Or, I mean, it could, obviously, like, you're meant to have, it goes against everything, you know, hyperbole and exaggeration and, like, too much metaphor. It's like, it makes it kind of childish or undisciplined, or it's not, you know, it's not erudite, is it? It's like, life is happening like this all the time for me. And for me, it's not at all unusual that somebody would turn around in their seat and look at you and smile at you, and suddenly, like, everything is on fire and there's, like, waves and tsunamis and, like, and then it's like, all right, cool, act natural, it's fine, absolutely fine. It's just the way I experience things. And, like, I also have this feeling that everybody else experiences things like that too. But people are hesitant to allow themselves to feel in their full capacities. I think because lots of people carry lots of fear about going there with their own feelings or something. But that might be complete conjecture. In fact, it is complete conjecture. So, but in a novel, you get to be the boss. Does that answer? Is that right? Yeah? Okay.
Would just David feel like that, do you
reckon? Yeah. David, like, the thing about David is he's so real with himself that within the novel, right, I said earlier, there's no heroes, there's no villains, but there are people who are being real with themselves and people that aren't being real with themselves, you know? And David, like, maybe he's pretty vacant, but he's completely real. Like, everything he says he means, he's got no shadow of, like, holding anything back. It just so happens that what he's got to offer is, like...
He feels like that when Miriam walks in his shop for the first time.
Yeah.
And when he finds out about his mum. you know, squirreling the money away. So, yeah, I'd say.
He's like, for me, he's like, he's real. He's a real guy, you know. Like, I can really respect that in him. I love that about him. And it's the characters, actually, who are hiding from themselves or hiding things from each other or cannot quite own up to the reality of what they want or who they are. Or these are the ones that have the kind of pain coursing through them, you know, I think.
Hi, this might be just one for me, but I wanted to ask about the William Blake thing. It's been around for you for a while and it interacts with a lot of your work in a huge way. I just wondered, when did William Blake happen for you, and is there a favourite part of his work that you'd recommend?
Yeah, I think I was about 19 or 20 when I first discovered William Blake, and it was with a poem, prose book called The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, in which he says, the road of excess leads to the palace of wisdom. So at 19, you're like, I fucking knew it. what else does he say? He says, you never know what is enough until you know what is more than enough. And he says, without contraries is no progression. And he rattled me to the core. And it's this kind of satirical, damning essay about how little other people really understand of themselves. And, like, you know, he talks about, he had this idea that creativity is the greatest act of worship of God, the God within man, and that to be creative is to enter the place from which we were created, you know. And everybody thought he was completely insane because of that, because it was like, you know, Christianity and reason and everything else. And he kind of went against everything. He thought, you know, his whole thing, he had to invent a new way of printing ink onto copper plates. He invented a new way of graving metal in order to be able to adequately illustrate the vision that he had for his work. Do you know what I mean? That's real.
That's
conviction, right? Yeah. That's like, I really responded to him so forcibly. Also, he's a South London human being, so I like that about him too.
Do we have another question?
Hi. Just want to say thank you for this awesome tour and for bringing your work to us and the way that you do write and bring life to the page absolutely thrills me when I'm reading your novel. At the end of the book, I felt that the three more or less stories concluding was less vivacious than the, you know, thrilling experiences that they'd had throughout the bulk of the novel. And do you feel that there's potential and scope for any of the characters to come back in another novel in the future?
I kind of feel like after writing, you know, a play, a poem, a record, a novel, I think it might be time to think of some new stories. But, like, I mean, I love them so much, but there was a decision to leave it where I left it. There was something for me about the way that it kind of softens and teeters and gradually, and we just leave them there. We just leave them there because the point of it, hopefully, I maybe shouldn't even say this because I've said it's all about what you make of it, but it could be anybody that we look at, that we put our lens up to, and we go into their personal lives and their history and their family and all the kind of generational everything. That could have been anybody. It just so happened that at that moment, the lens fell on Becky and Leon and Harry and Pete, you know. But then the lens shifts, and then you look at the next people on the street, you know, or then you look at yourself, or, you know. The idea is that this kind of constant churning presence of life, the only natural way for me to kind of leave it was to not tie anything up too tightly and just be like, okay, you know, something else to do. Something interesting to say about that is that I was doing one of these talks, and the lady that ran the bookstore I was talking, she was like, yeah, I was reading a book and then I left work and I was just crossing the road and I waved at the people in the car because I thought it was Becky, Harry and Leo. Do you know what I mean? That was so deep. And off they go, you know? So it could be anyone.
So it's up to you. Just look again.
I recall that I think it was Hafiz who said, a poet is one who can pour light into a spoon and raise it to one's parched and holy mouth to quench the spirit of that which we don't even recognize. And I'm thinking of this as I see you, because I see you as an incredibly seminal place in the arising of the radical medicine of really good poetry. And I want to ask you how you see in the world today, in the planetary play, the role of a good rap.
Wow, that was extremely well remembered for something that you weren't sure you were going to get right. That was that was amazing. The role of a good rap, or the role of a good poem, or the role of a good book, or a great show, or it's very important for me, artistic endeavour, because creativity plugs us more forcibly into our own humanity and then into the humanity of other people. So I'm religious about my work and about artwork in general. Like, when I watch a band playing a gig, it moves me to the point where I suddenly am alive. This is life now, you know? And I know how it feels to stand on stage. This is probably a lot through my work in performance that I know the transformative power. I've stood in rooms of people that terrify me, like absolutely terrify me, you know? That I could never have a conversation with. They are posturing and parading, very powerful people. I tell a poem and it's like, they become these vulnerable, real, honest human beings. And that's the power of poetry, of artistic endeavor. It takes it all off. A performance is not about what you put on, contrary to, you know, popular belief. It's about what you allow yourself to take off, to shed, to become more connected to the current that courses through everybody. So a great poem, it doesn't have to be a great poem, a canonized poem. It can be a few lines that somebody tells you, you know, in passing. It can be a rap that you have with a stranger on the street. It could be a book that you love that no one's ever heard of. Whatever it is that plugs you more forcibly into life. If you are blessed enough to have had that experience and you know what I'm talking about, then you know that it's real. And then you owe it to that experience to seek out other experiences like that. To allow yourself to be as dedicated a reader, a listener, a watcher, as the artists that you love are being writers, performers, thinkers. You know, it's like there is a circle to all this stuff. And I know personally that, I mean, I was watching Bjork, for example, not that long ago in a festival in New York, and I was exhausted. I've been on the road for ages. I didn't think I was going to be able to kind of get through the next week or whatever. And I saw her doing the songs from her latest record, and it was a beautiful, beautiful set with strings and all these incredible electronic instruments. I don't know even what they were. And I just saw her sing and go into this place. It was an album all about her breakup. It was heartbreaking stuff. And I just cried for an hour and a half, held up by my drummer, embarrassing myself in front of everybody, just weeping. Because apparently I needed to do that. And the only thing that could have brought me into that place was music. To just say to me, just stop pretending. Just be real with where you're at. And it's okay, you know? And like, I don't think there's anything else that I know of that can take me to that place with such a kind of, and take such care of me in that vulnerability. And not just in experiencing work, but in making it, I think that we are lacking that in our lives, this current, this connection, not just to ourselves, but to each other. So when, like, for me, my young teenagehood was spent raving, and like, there is something so powerful that I learned about a dark room full of bodies moving and loud bass, you know, and I take that with me. I feel that. That's worship. Like, and I grew up secular. I'm not, do you know what I mean? I'm not religious, but I have this deep connection to humanity when I experience the greatest thing that we can do, which I think is to create work. That's how I feel anyway. So yeah, I mean, I don't know if that's what you were looking for, but that's the way I feel about it. It's the stakes are that high for me. So, and if you recognize that sentiment and know that that's a powerful thing. So seek it out. And don't worry about if you're not educated in a particular artist's work, or you don't feel like you don't understand it, or you're not allowed it, don't worry about any of that. If it finds you, it's found you. And that's the most beautiful connection anyone could ever have with a piece of work, you know? Studying it and stifling it and taking all the life out of it and inflicting intellect on instinct is one thing, and fine if that's what you do. But if you feel it, if it's found you, it's for you. And that's a very special moment to be aware of.
I feel like, just as a comment, I feel like there's been this massive wave, in the Western world at least, of spoken word artists, rappers, poets, turning to fiction. And I feel like the way, I don't know any of you have read Omar Moussa's Here Come the Dogs, there's a particular thing you get when you stand up at the mic, and it is, you talk about it as a religious experience. It's like testifying. You know, once you stand up in front of people, you're saying, I have something that I want to tell you. And I feel like that carries through, somehow carries through to the way that poets treat prose. You know, there's something really raw about it that potentially is not there when you come to prose first. But is there the same wave in the UK? Are there a lot of people kind of moving from spoken word into the written word in terms of prose? Or
Yeah, there is actually. But that's so interesting what you say about this kind of standing up with something to say. There is something about telling your truth in a public place and seeking other people's truths, you know, that is, I think, it's specific to spoken word poets. Like, it's a feeling that we take for granted, maybe, because it's actually quite a special thing to be able to have in your mind and in your heart when you know what it feels like to stand up and go there in yourself. And there are lots of poets that I think are turning to fiction. And that's really exciting. But what I think is important to say, that if you're a writer, you should never limit yourself. Because when the idea comes into your brain, you need to do everything you possibly can to cultivate that idea, to create a space for it to be all the things that it wants to be before it's become the kind of faulted, terrible shit thing that it's going to be once you've finished it, because it had to go through the human process and come out of your hand, right? So, but in the idea, in its purest sense, you have to do everything you can to cultivate the capacities that can do the best for this idea. And the more limits and restrictions you put on that idea before it's come out, you know, the worse it is for the idea. So if you've only got one form that you're allowing the idea to manifest itself in, that's all it's ever going to be. But if you allow yourself to, like, open all the doors in the labyrinth, you know, it could go anywhere.
Well, we've got time for one final question.
Are you all right?
Thank you. Hello.
Hello.
The other night you mentioned mythology briefly on Q&A.
Yep.
And you talked about what you understand, I've got this, of what we lose by culturally now being separate from mythology that underpins our way of making meaning of story. Is that what you were talking about? I just wanted to say, could you elaborate on that? Because I didn't quite grab it.
Yeah, okay. So for me, being severed from mythology is to be severed from ourselves, and is why I think we have such a sickness at the core of our societies. Because, so on this intrepid journey to this moment that I've been on for the last month, I found in a bookstore, accidentally, at the end of my tether, Jung's The Red Book, open on a plinth in the middle of a room, right? Do you know what I mean? It's a bit rich, isn't it? You wouldn't write that, would you? You know what I mean? While journeying through Portland, exhausted, the poet wandered into a rare bookstore. But, and Jung talks about this a lot, and when I found it, when I found Jung's words about it, it really connected with what I was already kind of beginning to think, and he really solidified this for me, that there is a kind of common... Well, okay, I'm just going to go there. Fuck it. So there is a commonality to experience. What Jung has termed the spirit of the times versus the spirit of the depths. In each person, there is the spirit of the times, and this is what allows us to have careers and families and to think that we're really getting something done. The spirit of the depths is this kind of bigger, darker, more primal and eternal spirit, which is in us. It's like when we close our eyes, it's there. You know, it's it's full. And he has this kind of relationship with the spirit of the times and the spirit of the depth since he's a young boy, which he calls personality number one, personality number two. So, and I really connected with that. I used to feel like I had a kind of higher voice, a higher self that would talk to me and instruct me, which I often would have. So I would have problems with it. I'd either ignore, I'd be freaked out by, or I would dedicate myself to listening to, right? So I really connected with that when I heard that. And he talks about the spirit of the depths being what connects us to the eternal and also, you know, breadth-wise as well as backwards and forwards to each other, right? So in our severance from mythology, we have lost contact with the spirit of the depths. And if we allow ourselves to remember the loss that we feel, if we open our eyes to the reality of experience as it is, when we're walking around these cities, we have to blinker ourselves so much from the reality because it's too painful to really hold it. Then there are commonalities in our dreams, in our fears. There are mythological constants globally for humanity that we have kind of severed and lost in favor of mythology that has been inflicted upon us, I think, to cultivate a system of consumerism, consumption above all else. The individual, the myth of the individual above all else, I think has been very wounding, and it's a heavy mythology to live under. So in terms of in losing our kind of our religious framework, or our mythological framework, we are left with a framework that is kind of inflicted upon us by a system that I'm very suspicious of. Does this make sense to you or not? I don't know if this is... But you know what, it's when I'm talking about music and this connection to this place, which is the real place, it's very important, I think, and this is to remember the truth of what happens in a place and on the land. You know, the truth of the history, the truth of the current moment, the truth of the present tense, really engage with the reality of experience, you know, what is actually happening. And I think that that connects us to that place, and from that place, our mythology can begin to manifest itself again. So it's still in us, the desire, the needs, the same things are in us that were in us thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of years ago with the same beings, the same people. It just so happens that we've lost so many of the things that we need, and we've told ourselves to get over that. You know, it's okay, I've got a house, it's all right, I've got a car. It's all right. Got a job. Okay, my kids are at school. That's okay. But what you have a place in you that needs more than that. And I think that all this talk that I've been doing, I mean, I know we're probably going to run over time. I will stop in a minute. But like, I feel very passionate about this. I met an elder, an indigenous elder the other night, and she really moved me with some of the things she was saying about the grandmothers and about the old people, she called them. And about being in communication with the old people, she was singing a song, and in between the verses of the song, she would just say, love you, granny. She would say, love you, grandfather, just as she was singing. And this idea of not connecting with the ancients, not connecting with the old ones, allowing ourselves to be severed from time because we believe in progress or right now or contemporary, or it's a damaging thing. And I think that as painful as it is to acknowledge history, it's much more painful and bad for us to forget that we are ancient. And this is eternal, and to land in the moment is the most healthy way we can begin to move forwards.
Kate Tempest, this has been an extraordinary conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Maxine.
Having it. And thank you so much to the audience. Kate will be signing her books at the back later on in a few minutes. So please pick one up and get it signed and come back to us.
Yeah.
Don't leave us for too long.
Just one thing, like if you don't want to buy a book, it's okay. Like this is not all about selling the book. The tour may have begun that way. This is what I'm here to physically do. Yeah. But I feel very honoured to have had your company, and like thank you for being and sitting here and indulging me to just kind of waffle on with my, you know, anecdotal profundities. Like thank you for being a part of it. And if you don't want to buy a book, that's cool by me. But like, big up.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing, and ideas from Melbourne, Australia, and the world.